This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Let me acknowledge first thank Auntie Agnes and acknowledge the elders and the people of the country and where we now meet, and acknowledge the fact that they have conducted ceremonial and business on this country for millennia. Now, from its conception to its planning, to its conduct and its reporting, the expedition was quietly enmeshed in the main currents of Australian politics. And it throws light in the first instance on how the Australian government perceived the building blocks of nation building. It illuminates also government efforts to make permanent the temporary phenomena of wartime collaboration with the United States. And gradually it was enmeshed in the processes of Cold War alignment building. And by the time it reported, that was consolidated as the political culture, if you like, of Australian foreign policy. Now, you can read all about that in the paper that's been circulated from me, and were I to attempt to read that paper to you now, we'd be not 20 minutes behind in the program, we'd be about an hour and 20. So I will not inflict that on you, but I just want to talk. An awful lot of the political detail, the attitudes, the views of the Australian government at the time, I'd draw attention to my paper if you'd have a chance to have a go through that. I also think you ought to take advantage of another person connected with the events of the time, Mary Corwell, who's in the audience here, who's Arthur Corwell's daughter, a very erudite scholar in her own right. And in the correspondence that Martin Thomas made very generously available to me between Arthur Corwell and Frank Setzler, both subsequent to the expedition, she features, but as a very tiny thing. So that's where they exchange information about their children. Well, I've talked about general propositions, but this expedition was driven by the idiosyncratic views of one powerful politician in the Curtin and Chifley governments, who had a somewhat different take on the character of Australian-American relations than many of his colleagues, a different take on the nature of the Cold War and the structure of Australian society than did many of his Labor colleagues. And while all were committed, he and his Labor colleagues, to the relationship and shared a view on the importance of science in nation building, Corwell was much more inclined to grasp the rationale of the burgeoning Cold War, less inclined to see value in the long-standing Australian-British connection, and determined through immigration policy to render Australia more American-like, and not convinced of the need, and very convinced of the need to seize opportunities for Australian and American collaboration. You know, I was thinking as I listened to the presentations this morning, and as I look out to the presentations further on, you're going to be deeply enmeshed in politics, but absolutely nothing to do with the politics I'm interested in. But very important in appropriate scientific and anthropological studies. I'm going to talk about metapolitics, the stuff of which the people who participated in the expedition would be scarcely aware. Though Frank Setzler, I think, came to understand it pretty thoroughly subsequent to the events in which he was a participant. Now, the distinctions I drew between Arthur Corwell's views and those of his colleagues are not absolute. They're basically nuanced distinctions. But at the time that Corwell was funding Mountford's lectures in the United States, he was embroiled in controversy in Parliament about what it was that he was doing in the United States. He had, for example, hired, at the same time that Mountford was there, he had hired one of Australia's leading advertising executives to do a tour of the United States in order to advise him on how we might propagandise them. And I just quote from his letter to a bloke named Frank Goldberg, who was in the United States at the same time as Mountford. I have great pleasure in inviting you during your forthcoming visit to the United States and Canada to investigate on my behalf the use and availability of commercial advertising media in those countries for presenting in the post-war period the case of Australia in relation to tourist traffic, trade possibilities, migration advantages, and allied subjects. We realise that there is still a very big task to be accomplished in making known abroad Australia's urgent need of greater population, the opportunities it can offer to new citizens, the possibilities that our national post-war developments will cater for a big expansion of our international trade, and the amazing untapped resource of interest that Australia can offer to tourists seeking relaxation from their ordinary, normal spheres of activity. But that in itself was a blind. It was not about tourism at all. It was about building a great Australian nation, and it was about defending that nation. That is what Arthur Calwell's migration program and propaganda program was all about. The first thing is that he believed that we needed a massive migration. That's the first point. And the second point is that he believed that that migration should have incorporated within it some form of settlement across the north. That if that large number of migrants who came into the country merely went into Sydney and Melbourne, which is precisely what they did, if they merely went into Sydney and Melbourne, a massive opportunity for development would be missed. So you can find in Arthur Calwell's speeches and correspondence of the time constant reference to the need to populate our northern areas as well as the southern capital cities. He had in mind a nation building through that process. He also was specifically interested in the idea of it being American migration that came to Australia. He was impressed with the possibilities of Americans' preparedness to migrate, and he went there on several trips himself to encourage them to get on board. He also sent out huge amounts of information through his department, through the American school system. I mean, the appearances of Frank Mountford's films in the United States was a small aspect of what was an all-court press on the American education system as they tried to pour into the United States propaganda about Australia. And he was very pleased to announce at one point of time the 1,000th American post-war migrant to Australia. The Americans did point out to him that whilst he was there advocating that the United States, that Australia was God's own country, they rather had that feeling about it themselves. Not Australia, but the United States. But Arthur said, well, you're wrong about that, and I'm right. He also believed that Australia should be a different country. Now, it is hard for us to put ourselves in the minds of Australians at the time. We think that the American alliance began with Curtin's statement that looking without pangs as connections to the past, we look now to the United States. Forget it. The United States' relationship with Australia in World War II sat very lightly on the thinking of Australian politicians. The principal initiative by Curtin and Chifley after the war and in the latter phases of the war was to reinvigorate imperial defence. And their desire, however, was, because imperial defence had failed so massively in the 1930s, to have a genuine imperial defence which assumed that the empire was broader than London and that Australia would control the Australian end of it. Chifley and Curtin were still enmeshed in the idea that we were part of the Sterling Trading Bloc. The most important element of the Sterling Trade Bloc at the time was Malaya. It was the biggest dollar earner for Britain. The Americans had a massive desire for tin and rubber from Malaya. So we argued, they were arguing at the time, that we needed a revival of the empire, we needed a resurrection of Britain, we needed Britain to acknowledge that we are running the empire in this area, and that ought to be the focus of Australian foreign policy at the time. Very careful about being engaged in Cold War commitments, lest we be distracted, because the principal concern in their minds was not Russia, it was still Japan and keeping Japan down. So that was the outlook of the Australian political leadership at the time. It changed. It did change. That was not Arthur Calwell's outlook. He did not see Australia as independent Britons in the Southern Hemisphere. Arthur Calwell was committed more to the idea of a polyglot community like the United States. His information department heavily propagandised the United States, not only to play into the US, but to play back into Australia, to reinforce his efforts to change the character of migration patterns, which was to reorient it away from a focus exclusively on Britain, basically to a focus on continental Europe and the big continental European migrant communities which so predominated affairs in the United States. He wanted to see replicated here. He was free of British commitments, Arthur. In his ancestry, he saw two lines. One was American, the other was Irish. And the British were tormentors of both of them. And while he was circumspect in the way he expressed these views in Australian politics, and you can find plenty of quotes from Arthur with the usual obeisance to British commitments, Arthur did not believe it. His subliminal agenda was an agenda which was distinct from the British culture that most people saw as vital to us. He and all his colleagues were deeply impressed with General Douglas MacArthur. There was one component. Though the orientation, as I said, for organisation of defensive efforts after the war largely focused on Britain, there was nevertheless an attempt to engage the Americans, which at that point of time largely failed, because where we wanted to engage the Americans and why we wanted to engage the Americans was of no interest to the United States, whose concerns had shifted from the southern to the northern Pacific. But nevertheless, though the alignment with Britain was seen, MacArthur was a worshipped figure by political leadership in Australia. The Australian soldiers hated him, but the Australian politicians loved him. They loved the respect he showed them. They loved the significance that he awarded to, in his mind, to Australia as a massive base for the operations of both Australian and American forces. And even though he persisted in referring to Australian soldiers as allies and not Australians, which is why they were persistent in referring to him as Dugout Doug, he nevertheless had to accept the fact that Roosevelt determined that he would get no soldiers, and it was not until the invasion of the Philippines in 1944 that Douglas MacArthur had more American troops under his command than Australian. And even when MacArthur was finally sent in with a decent number of American soldiers into the Philippines, he did not give him as many as he gave General Mark Clark for operations in the side theatre of Italy at exactly the same point of time. There's different views. The American view of MacArthur was ambivalent. The Australian view was wholehearted. And let me read, because Arthur Calwell was immensely proud that he got situated in the Australian Parliament a remembrance motion for, which was unusual in those days for a non-parliamentarian, for Douglas MacArthur. And this very movingly is how he concluded it, which showed you exactly what he thought about him. Now he is dead. There is neither rank nor station nor prerogative in the democracy of the dead or the republic of the grave. For us, however, Douglas MacArthur belongs to the immortal dead. He belongs forever in the hearts and history of the Australian people. In the words of the poet, this country, as does his own, owes him the debt immense of endless gratitude. You'd never get a speech about Douglas MacArthur that ended like that in the United States. But that was Arthur's feeling about him. So he was deeply impressed. It also meant that earlier than Chifley and Evatt, he was prepared to see the world in the way in which the Americans were beginning to perceive it. He was prepared to see it as beginning to evince elements where the standoff was not a simple quarrel between old allies mitigated or mediated effectively through the United Nations or an international organisation, but as a distinct ideological divide. He was prepared to see the world, in other words, in Cold War terms, much more actively than was his American were his other counterparts, particularly Chifley and Evatt. He was therefore more inclined to an anti-communist position than was Chifley and Evatt. So, for example, during the miners' strike of 1949, when the Chifley government put the troops in to operate the coal fields, which was a very significant event in the evolution of Australian thinking about the Cold War, Arthur Calwell, in his speeches in Parliament, talked about a communist conspiracy. Chifley, in his speeches in Parliament, talked about a threat to centralised wage fixing that would possibly have deleterious effects or inflationary pressures inside Australia. So he was much more comfortable with the way in which the ideological debate was taking place than were his counterparts in the Australian Labor Party. He was a more, in its context of the time, a more modern political figure. Now, in the course of his time with the expedition, and he very much saw the expedition as a starting point for a long-term scientific collaboration between Australia and the United States. And he certainly saw it in the context of the possibility that something might emerge from this sort of collaboration which would take more of the features of an alliance. He had all those various purposes which I've outlined, but he also developed a marvellous friendship with Frank Setzler. And the correspondence between them is itself a little snapshot in time of Australian Cold War thinking. And I thought I might just conclude by quoting from some of that correspondence. When they started off correspondence, it was Mr. Calwell, as far as Frank Setzler was concerned, and it was Dr. Setzler, as far as Arthur Calwell was concerned. But that rapidly became Cousin Frank and Cousin Arthur in the conversations between the two of them, and with constant reference by Cousin Frank to Cousin Arthur, that Cousin Arthur better visit the US again so he could catch up with his real cousins in Pennsylvania. And, of course, in the 1950s, when this correspondence took place, Calwell was a much more powerful figure in the Labor Party than he had been in the 40s. But I'll give you something of a vignette of the way in which politicians thought, the urgency, the troubles that they saw emerging in the Cold War. And Calwell writes in 51, "Since your letter arrived, the Korean War has been halted by truce talks, while MacArthur's dismissal created almost as great a sensation in this country as it did in America. And the after effects are still being felt. The Persian oil crisis has come, and whilst not yet over, I doubt if it will be the starting point of the Third World War. On the whole, it looks as if there will be no war in Europe this year. If we get past August and September, there should be no major conflict before August or September of 1952, if at all. And then by 1953, the United States will be so powerful, and the Allied and Western democracies will be helped by her to become much more powerful than they are today. The World War III may be avoided for a considerable period of time, if not altogether." Now, these letters are an authentic Cold War correspondence between two liberal anti-communists. Neither is in doubt about the necessity of American power, nor of Australia's alignment with it. Both are fearful that each manifestation of conflict might lead to a wider war, but hope wisdom will prevail. They are classic containment advocates in a debate which at the time revolved around whether a more aggressive strategy should be pursued against the Soviet Union. They share the Australian sense of its unique isolation and vulnerability in a culturally alien and potentially hostile Asian environment. Both hope for a Labor victory in the various elections in the period. Both are confident that such an event will not change Australia's alignment, but will temper necessarily anti-communism with social justice. Both are alive to democratically debilitating paranoia. in the fraught Cold War ideological environment. Now, I note from the time that I really better start thinking about winding this up, since you all managed to get the program very late and there are other people who need to speak. But I just want to take one little piece of it, because there's constant reference back into the expedition or events in the expedition by Arthur Cawell and Frank Setzler in their discussions. And one piece of correspondence is about the Petrov affair, which probably nobody here recollects, but there was a defection of a KGB agent, Petrov. His wife was seized by a couple of KGB heavies, and they were dramatically intercepted as they were flown out through Darwin. They were seized in Darwin, and at least the KGB heavies were seized, and Mrs. Petrov was liberated. And great excitement was had by all. But the but Setzler imagines this, and so he writes. And I think the tonality of this gives a bit of an idea about where they are situated on the political spectrum at the time. And he says to Arthur, "I could well imagine the excitement in Darwin, and clearly picture every action that was made, even to the excellent view Mrs. Petrov would have had from Government House. I marvel at the more conservative method of handling such a case, as in contrast to what might happen here. Our McCarthy Army case, relating to hypothetical commies, is due to go off the television air today. Such a thing would only happen here. Now the housewives can get back to their chores." But you see, you've got to comprehend this at the time. Where is he situated here? This is to the left in American politics. That is a position that is to the left. Cawell, of course, is to the left in Australian politics. But the two of them had this view that communism was best resisted from the centre-left, not from the far right. Democratic values were better protected from the centre-left, not from the far right. And so they tended to be, in their correspondence, pretty disparaging of the McCarthyite extreme right and some of the sentiments that espoused by the Australian Liberal Party at the time, but very alive to stupidity on the left, which would let the right run with those issues, a la Evatt's handling of the Petrov affair, which Cawell gave him a baking for in his correspondence also with Frank Setzler. But Frank really hoped to see Arthur emerge as Prime Minister. He got to love him during the course of the expedition and the meetings that he had had with him. And he says this at one point of time when Arthur's deputy leader, hopefully about to become leader of the Labor Party. He says this about the reports from the Arnhem Land expedition. "All of us are anxiously awaiting the publication of the Arnhem Land expedition reports. Their timely publication should bring credit to the 1948 leaders of the party," and he didn't mean by that the party that went on the expedition. "Who knows, their publication may even assist in a future election." Well, I've got to tell you, we got no bang for the buck from this expedition. None at all. It was a vast disappointment as far as we in the Australian Labor Party were concerned. But what a terrific thing it was for Australia, and what a good thing it was for relations between the two countries.
Thank you very much, Kim, for Professor Beasley, for an extraordinarily erudite, well, I shouldn't use that word, impressive, perceptive and knowledgeable speech, because as you know, over the last 40 years, there's been a lot of material has been contoured to get a desired result, and some people confuse polemicism with history. But I'm truly grateful for recovering and giving the broader context as well. And you sort of alluded to the fact, you're probably aware, that my father's grandfather was an American, Davis Colwell, who was nearly 21, his brother nearly 23, when they came to the Ballarat Goldfields. He was a young school teacher from Pennsylvania, and his father was an Irishman who married a Pennsylvanian Dutch girl, and his father Dan was elected to the House of Representatives in Pennsylvania in 1820. So we do have a political lineage. And he wrote to his American cousins as cousin, and I think this was an extension of that feeling that we did have an emotional and as well as a family connections. And if you permit me, I'd just like to mention too that my father introduced Australian citizenship in 1949 for the first time, which also is enhanced by, is connected with what you said. Also that Mountford was a senior officer in the Department of Information, and he approached my father in 1945. And the whole collaboration was a wonderful achievement. My father quoted in the introduction to the four volumes of the expedition's results from Bernard O'Dowd, who described this continent as last sea thing dredged by sailor time from space. And he promoted Australian literature very strongly. And if I could just take 1 minute more to say that the Department of Information has been extraordinarily neglected, but, and its heritage in war and peacetime was outstanding. They had correspondence in many war zones during the war. There's many metres of material at the War Memorial that nobody's ever looked at. Radio Australia had a listening post. It was under the control of the department. And the listening post had linguists listening to war broadcast from other countries, and the Friday before the 15th of August 1945, when Australia were told by Mr. Chifley about 9 in the morning that we had won the war, on the previous Friday, the listening post could tell us that because they were getting broadcasts from the Japanese pleading for peace. And just very quickly, in August 1945, the department had offices in Britain, America, Canada and India, controlled Radio Australia and broadcast 18 hours a day in several languages, including Japanese, Chinese, Malay, Dutch, Thai and French, assisted by the Department of External Affairs and the Postmaster General's Department. They provided lectures, films, articles, publications, contributed to overseas newspapers, and collaborated in America with private organisations, as you mentioned. In 1948, they distributed material to Europe and the USA, including films, and 40 million Americans heard radio broadcasts every month. Also, Radio Australia worked 23 hours a day, receiving letters from 50 countries. And many Australian journalists, including and other people who later became famous in other areas, who worked with them included Geoffrey Sawyer, Gavin Long and Al Stivens. So I'm most grateful to Klim especially and to this National Museum for recovering the importance of information, Department of Information, and I hope you'll pursue it further. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary Corwell. You know, there's all sorts of ways of recovering history at the National Museum of Australia, and it's, you know, these unanticipated moments that we get it inspired in this case by Professor Beasley, a professor in that time. Time for more questions or comments from the floor. Martin Thomas.
Yeah, thank you for a wonderful talk, Kim. I had, in fact, two questions come to mind. One is to do with race, and as Mary pointed out, this is one of the ways in which Corwell is really remembered now, and the expedition seems something of an aberration in that regard, because for the interest in Aboriginal culture, so I'd wondering whether you could comment on that in terms of his general reputation. And the other is to do with internationalism, the formation of the UN at this time, and also the very prominent role of Corwell's rival, H.V. Everett, in the formation of the UN, and just quite what's happening there, because I think it's certainly ruffling some feathers in Washington in terms of Washington, in terms of Everett really wanting to promote more of a small nation sort of agenda.
That's the rest of my paper. But can I first take the race issue? Arthur Call was a vigorous defender of the White Australia policy, well beyond when the White Australia policy collapsed. And for a period of time, that has come to typify Arthur Call's, in the public mind, his view on the issue of race. His view is more complicated than that. One of the first speeches he made in Parliament was an attack on Australian neglect of the Aboriginal population and cruelty to them, and that was a persistent theme of Arthur Corwell's in the various speeches that he made in Parliament at a time when nobody said that sort of thing. That's the first thing. The second thing is he spoke Mandarin, and it's a Labor Party habit which... Had I learned it, I probably would have done better in political life. But but he also was a campaign worker for the first Chinese elected to the Melbourne City Council. So he had his views on race were complicated views. Views on Aboriginal culture at the time. Look, one of the hidden things in Australian historiography of World War II. Is the fact that Indigenous Australians were in the front line of Australian defence. We concentrate on the Tobruks and the Kokoda Trails and the rest of it. Really, Australia's value to the Allies in World War II was a massive supply dump and as a defensive fortress with the most mobilised female population in the world and an active engagement of the Aboriginal community. Now, some of that engagement has a question mark over it because payments were bad in a number of areas. But not for the more than 2,000 Aboriginal soldiers who were in the AIF, who were all paid, of course, the same wages as the other soldiers who were in the AIF. And even some, and it's been made up since then, the AIF battalion in the Torres Strait Islands. And right across the north, apart from performing essential labour, in all the enormous number of air bases and the like established across the north, the Aboriginals were also organised into guerrilla forces in anticipation of invasion. And those Aboriginal guerrilla forces still exist in the form of the Northern Surveillance Units. And that was the origins of them were then. And, in fact, the first Japanese taken prisoner on Australian soil was taken by an Aboriginal. Who said to him in the best language of the Darwin matinees of the time, stick 'em up all the same, Hopalong Cassidy. But there's that view that we had had a close run thing in that we did not properly comprehend the North, and that we needed an understanding of the North, and this was part of developing that. The side benefit, from our point of view, is that we'd have a more comprehensive understanding of regions which they thought ought to be settled. Now, on the internationalism side, and the second of your questions, Everett and Chifley came out of World War II with two layers of commitments, really. How do we support Franklin Delano Roosevelt's idea about global collective security and the formation of the United Nations? So when gradually the Americans and the British on one side and the Russians on the other, Soviets on the other, started to set up a structure of international relations based on a Cold War clash, the view from Everett and Chifley was we've got to resist this trend and to assert the old perspective. The idealistic objective of FDR. Now, that was not just simply for idealistic reasons. There was realism in that. What sort of role can Australia play in international political circumstances dominated by the Soviet Union and the United States? None. What sort of role can we play in a situation where you've got events mediated through an international body, international law and the rest of it? A lot. And... I mean, it led to quite interesting clashes. I don't mention it in my paper, but, for example, Menzies opposed the creation of the State of Israel. Menzies supported the British position, which was hostile to Israel, and at the time that was developing, creation of Israel was seen as a Soviet objective and certainly as an anti-Arab objective. But Evatt supported it. Israel would not have existed without Evatt's manoeuvring in the United Nations. That's a complex story. But the world as you try to see it now from the lens isn't the world that we are inhabiting when we're doing expedition and seeing the same sort of the same set of circumstances. Gradually that paradigm falls apart. The other side of it was Evatt was trying, under the framework of the United Nations, to get the Americans to sign up to a Pacific Agreement. He wanted to exchange bases with the Americans, or reciprocal rights on bases with the Americans. The Americans weren't interested. The Americans were beginning to think of the Japanese differently. The Australians were thinking of the neutralisation and the pastoralisation, frankly, of Japan. The Americans were thinking of the rebuilding of Japan and the incorporation of Japan within the structure of the emerging Cold War alliance. So there's a fundamental disagreement. And Evatt and Chifley were saying, the damn thing's happening all over again. In the same way as imperial defence collapsed when the British had to confront Germans and they didn't have enough resources to confront the Japanese, now they're talking about a Cold War in Europe and a Cold War in the Middle East. And again, they're committing Australians to that. And who knows what will emerge from Japan when the burden of occupation is lifted on them, off them, we've got the same problem again. So that's the way they were thinking of those sorts of issues at the time. It's more complex than immediately meets the eye.
Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.